From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Oxford-educated classicist Dr. Spencer Clavin, author of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Spencer Clavin in their conversation.
Heraclitus was the real deal relativist. He went whole hog. He believed that all was in flux, and indeed that every perception is a perception of something different at each moment. And one of his disciples ended up, we're told, saying nothing at all, because every statement would be false the moment it was uttered. And because everything was constantly in this flow of atoms. And so all he did was move his finger. That is a relativist with the courage of his convictions. Other people who live their lives as if God does not exist include the Marquis de Sade, right? I mean, these are people who actually operate as if there is no morality, there's no absolute truth. You who are listening to us have this conversation don't live that way and really can't, because in fact, in your heart of hearts, you know it's not right. You know it's not true that good and bad is just what, you know, we make of it, that there is no right or wrong, but thinking makes it so, that the universe is meaningless. You get out of bed in the morning, and by that very act, you prove that something else is there. There is some good, right? Every action that we do implies some good that we're aiming at. And so, you know, if you're teetering on the brink of this stuff, of this nihilism, of this despair, if that's how you're operating in your life, what you really just have to do is come back to yourself and just notice that, like, every day, every morning, you open your eyes and you stand up and you do something, make yourself a cup of coffee. Why do you do that? Well, because you want coffee. Why do you want coffee? Well, because coffee is good, right? You think it's good for you, or you think it's going to do something good. And right in that moment, the minute you say that, you have to realize that you have something in your mind called the good that you measure your actions by, that you use to guide your life. And that North Star, which is present in the simplest act that you do every morning, that North Star is the one that's going to guide you home to what you really believe.
I want you to expand on one of the other statements you make in the book. You say, I'm not trying to refute or disprove any claim that science makes. I am trying to invest science once again with the glory it has stolen from itself by answering questions it was never designed to ask.
C.S. Lewis, in his Space Trilogy, which, if people haven't read that, it's, I think, his best fiction. Right at the beginning of the Space Trilogy, Lewis talks about the mythology which follows on in the wake of science. That's what I'm talking about in that passage as well. I'm not talking for a second about, you know, you need to live in a mud hut and you need to tear down the telephone wires outside your house, or you need to, whatever, because where would that end, right? I mean, we've been making tools since we have existed as a species. That's not what I'm trying to rob you of or anybody of. I don't want anybody to give up on the search for truth, even scientific truth. What I do want to do is take the burden off of science that science has placed upon itself and cannot sustain. I mean, I represent the science, trust the science, light a prayer candle to Dr. Fauci. That's a real thing, by the way. I mean, you know, these are acts of worship that just won't work when you bring them to a science that exists purely for dealing with physical material objects. I mean, what does the Bible say about idols, right? They have eyes but do not see. They have mouths but do not speak. They're carved. Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, says that he cuts down a tree. He uses one half of it for firewood, and then he carves the other half into a statue and he bows down before it. The things of this world, the physical stuff that the world is made out of, is good, is created by God, but cannot sustain our worship. That's the central insight of the Hebrew Bible and of Jerusalem, right? And we laugh at those, you know, dumb old idol worshipers who bow down before wooden carvings. But here we are, right, talking to our AI as if it were alive, right? Writing programs and saying, you know, what should we do about climate change? Feeding it into our models and acting according to those predictions, right? All of this is a kind of idol worship, and all idol worship just turns the worshiper into the deaf, blind, and dumb, mute statue that he's worshiping. And that's kind of the position we're now in. Science can't sustain the worship that we're putting on it because it was never designed to. It was never meant to. It has its own place, its own thing to do. And it's not to satisfy our craving for worship, because there's only one thing that can do that.
I don't think it's trite to say last but not least in terms of the crises that you enumerated in your book. The last crisis is the regime crisis. What do you mean by the crisis of regime?
Well, the word regime is another one that, you know, people use it all the time for all sorts of different meanings. When I use the word regime, I'm talking about something very close to the ancient Greek notion of politics. And when we say politics, what we mean is like tax hikes or, you know, municipal paving or whatever sort of uninteresting issue that we don't want to have to deal with at the city council meeting. And so when we say don't get political, what we mean is don't drag into this kind of pleasant conversation, these issues of voting or these fights that we might have over Republican and Democrat. And I think that the reason why so many of our political fights have reached a stalemate is because they are political in exactly that narrow sense. They are based on this kind of, what are we going to do about this particular problem right now? Well, we have totally opposing first principles about it, so we just have to get in a big fight. Politics in the Greek origin is the word politike, techne politike. And politike is, again, a word that comes from polis, which just means a city-state or a community. You might call it a koinonia, a life together, a shared life. And what Aristotle famously says about that kind of politics is that man is by nature a political animal. And what that means is that we do not get born into this world, you know, drawing charts about tax policy. What that means is that wherever there are human beings, there are customs, rituals, and rules of life together. That's politics in the deep sense, and your regime, your kind of operative leadership class, those are the people who are in charge of that, who kind of operate according to those rules, but also set those rules, help to enforce them. And your small c constitution is the whole shape of that life together. So not just our big C constitution, which are the, just the law of the land, but what Aristotle refers to as, you know, marrying and intermarrying, doing festivals together, going to baseball games. He wouldn't have put it that way, but if Aristotle were alive today, I'm sure he would be a Yankees fan. And, you know, this whole concept, you know, what are we even doing here? Why are we, you know, living together? Why do we have neighbors? Why would we go to a town council meeting or to a PTA meeting? And when you get up against that, then you can really start to talk about, well, what's the shape of our regime? And so I go into in the book this, you know, ancient idea of the cycle of regimes, the different kinds of living together that people do and the way that they kind of fall from grace over time. The American regime, as founded, is what's called a republic, which is designed to be a perpetual motion machine, which is to say it takes the different kinds of regime, the different kinds of government, and balances them against one another so that each form of decay is kind of met with another sort of remedy from elsewhere. So I go into some of the writing of the founding fathers and how that genius act that they performed in the 1770s of building the foundations of our country was based on their profound erudition and close reading of the ancient sources that developed this whole idea. Why is this important for today? Is, well, you know, we're facing a crisis in America, but I'm not sure that everybody knows quite what kind of a crisis we're up against. And really what we're up against is a crisis of what's called civic love. Philia, politike philia, political friendship or love is the missing ingredient in really all of our political debates. And it's not like some nice touchy-feely, lovey-dovey, sing kumbaya. It's the actual work every day of waking up in the morning and operating with the guy next to you, not on Twitter, not out in Washington, whatever, but with the guy next to you as if you have a shared and common goal. And so that's what I end up arguing for in the book as something that people can actually do without relying on the next big election or the next big crisis. And something that we can actually do when we wake up tomorrow to help take this country forward.
Just a little more elaboration on the cycle of regimes. You started on that, but I think it's such an important concept for people to grasp. Monarchy becoming tyranny, aristocracy becoming oligarchy, and democracy becoming mob rule. And maybe in concert with that, the maxim that hard times create strong men create good times create weak men, and then weak men create the hard times again.
I really love that quote because it's just perfectly kind of a modern vernacular encapsulation of this ancient concept, which in Greek you would call anacyclosis. which is a kind of fancy word just meaning the cycle and recycling of regimes. In ancient political philosophy, going back, you know, to, in some sense, to Plato, also there's in the great historian Herodotus, there's sort of a discussion of these sorts of things, but then really formalized in Aristotle. You have these three types, three ways of doing life together that are kind of basic, right? And they are, as you mentioned, they are monarchy, aristocracy, and the name differs throughout history, but, you know, we would call it democracy, rule by the many. And so you have rule by one man, rule by a few, and rule by the many. And because humanity is broken, each of these kinds of rules is capable of decay. And the crucial feature of that decay is good governments are ruled by people who have the good of the ruled in mind. So a good king rules for the good of his subjects. A good aristocracy rules for the good of the rest of the people. And indeed, even a good majority, a good democratic polity, will make choices based on the good of that group.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with scholar Spencer Klavan. Is it closing time for the West? In his new book, How to Save the West, Spencer Klavan warns that the situation is dire, but we face no crisis today that we have not faced before. Summoning insights of Plato, Aristotle, the Bible, and the founding fathers of the United States, Dr. Klavan shows our hope for the future is in the wisdom of the past, wisdom that will improve the reader's own life and can ultimately save the West. To receive your copy of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal. Just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. The Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the Revised and Updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. So rapid and pandemic has been the decline of biblical literacy and spiritual discernment that our once unimaginable post-truth culture is effectively becoming an anti-truth culture. While the sun is setting on the Western Church, Islam is now the fastest growing religion in the world. This means that it's not simply enough to be aware of this threat. Christians need to wake up, stand up, and speak up. This means being able to counter the outright lies about Islam that otherwise will go unchecked with horrendous consequences. And that's what Hank Hanegraaff's book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, will enable you to do. To receive your copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, Call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's many outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Spencer Klavan, as they continue their conversation.
Good governments are ruled by people who have the good of the ruled in mind. So a good king rules for the good of his subjects. A good aristocracy rules for the good of the rest of the people. And indeed, even a good majority, a good democratic polity, will make choices based on the good of that group and not trample on what we would now call minority rights, right? In America, because we have this notion of our democracy and because we are indeed founded as a republic, we're typically inclined to say, oh, monarchy bad, right? We rebelled against a king. George III is gone now. So we have to, and we certainly don't want to be ruled by Harry and Meghan. So we think, you know, this is like a kind of a bad thing altogether. But the ancient truth is actually that, you know, in different contexts, different places, different times, each of these forms of government can be done well, but if it can be done well, it can also be done badly. And human beings being what they are, they're going to eventually start to decay. And so Aristotle, and then later after him, Polybius, who was a historian of the rise of the Roman Empire, Polybius writes that there is this kind of natural cycle that occurs as the different regimes decay and replace one another. And so you begin with monarchy and maybe you have a good king, but inevitably you're going to get, you know, a degenerate son, let's say, a son that's spoiled, just raised from his youth as a kind of ne'er-do-well. And eventually what you'll end up with is a tyrant, somebody who just wants to rule for his own good, his own sake. Tyranny begets resentment, of course, as we have seen many a time in even America's history. People want to rise up against oppressive rule. And so you get what you think of as kind of an aristocratic revolution. The noblemen, think of like King John and his barons and the writing of Magna Carta in English history. The noblemen rise up and assert their right not to be unduly taxed, what have you. But of course, if they take over, well, then you've got just a bunch of cronies eventually, right? People who start to do backroom deals for themselves and for their own benefit. And the people begin to resent that. And so you have a natural spirited reaction, which is a popular revolution, gets you to a kind of democratic state. But democracy of all things, pure democracy, is the most fragile and degenerates into what's called ochlocracy, the rule of the mob, mob rule. Abraham Lincoln warned of this in his Lyceum Address. The whole point of this, of course, once you end up in mob rule, then you can get a strong man who comes in and exerts control, as we saw in Chaz Chop not too long ago, the autonomous zone, and then you end up just starting the cycle again. So the question is, how do we get out of the cycle? How do we break the cycle? The answer, the classical answer is, well, we build a structure that plays these different forms of power, different forms of rule against one another. You'll have a leader. You'll have a leadership class, the aristocracy, call it the Senate, for instance. And then you'll have the people who have some input either through judges or through voting, right? I mean, in our case, of course, we have the vote, right? The thing that this kind of system is most vulnerable to, and Machiavelli, the great, you know, the writer of Realpolitik, Machiavelli is really great about this. And he observes how Rome fell after, you know, Polybius wrote about the greatness of this republic. And as the empire started to come really into focus, he says, what happened? Well, you really had class dissension. You had fights between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots. And once you understand that's the Achilles heel of the republic, right? When we split apart according to our groups, according to our tribes, so that we're not operating on one machine, but we're, as Plato says, we're two cities in one or two countries in one, then you are on the road to perdition. Once you understand that, then you understand why it's so poisonous to tell people that their identity is rooted in some other kind of demographic feature besides their common cause as Americans, that you are not actually, you know, first and foremost an American, you're first and foremost a person of color, you're first and foremost an LGBTQIA plus individual, you're first and foremost, you know, just any number of kind of demographic categories, an Asian American, let's say. And that creates, instead of a republic, a zero-sum game where people are just fighting over goodies and preferential treatment. This is why, you know, you might think that you'd be kind of like beating a political hobby horse or something here. But this is why conservatives are reacting so strongly against the tribalism of the left. It's not because, you know, oh, those, you know, we want to own the libs, or we want to, you know, fight back against all those nasty Marxists or whatever. It's because it's this stuff is poison. It's poison to a republic. It corrodes the bonds that are supposed to hold us together. If we start to think of ourselves as organized into these interest groups, all against all, group against group, until there's nothing left.
A couple of last questions. I think they're axiomatic. We've talked about the dark side of technology. There's a bright side to technology as well.
That's right. I really want to stress this because I have a lot of criticisms about how technology is currently used in the book. But just like when the printing press came into being and it unleashed all sorts of chaos and there were all sorts of negative reactions, but ultimately what you had was this kind of explosive ability now to place information in people's hands. We've got a lot of people in this country and around the world generally who want to seize control of our digital communications technology. You want to say what you can and can't say online. I want to cancel people, want to hound them out of jobs. All of that stuff is very real, very dangerous. I don't want to minimize it. And I don't want to suggest that, like, you know, they're going away anytime soon. But I do want to say that by the nature of the technology itself, they are ultimately bound to fail. When people take this stuff into their own hands, when we use this tech to found businesses, to communicate with one another, to organize, right, to realize that we're actually not crazy for thinking that man should be judged by the content of his character, not the color of his skin, right? Then we are doing what this technology enables us to do at the highest possible level. The use that we put this tech to ought to be guided by the ancient principles, not the other way around. We don't throw out our ancient principles because we develop new tech. We take whatever new tech that may come and we understand it in light of the great wisdom of the past.
Few last words as you titled your last chapter. You talk about where our salvation lies, the salvation for the West, the salvation for our culture, the salvation for Western civilization. You point out that if America falls, it doesn't mean that Western civilization falls. You're arguing that the salvation for Western civilization, or even for America, lies in doing daily things that have built the West, starting families, going to church, working, saving, investing, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, doing the very things that Jesus said, you know, if you've done this for the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. Expand for just a moment on that concept, which you so powerfully proclaim in the book, that we need to affect those things which we can affect rather than just criticizing things that we have no handle on and no real opportunity to change.
Thank you. Yeah, that's beautifully put. And here's what I would stress. You know, if America falls or undergoes radical transformation even more than it has, that will be a catastrophe. I don't want to laugh off or shrug off the urgency of the ballot box, of this country. We are the city on a hill still, you know, as we go, so goes freedom in the world, at least for the time being. But the thing to remember, beyond all of that, to stave off despair, and because it's true, is that when you understand yourself as a citizen of the West, and when you know that the reason America matters is because she is the great inheritor and the great carrier of these traditions forward into the future, then you also understand that the game you're playing, the project you're in, is longer than a human life and is orchestrated by more than a human hand. And as you start to examine the history of the West, you will realize that it is full of moments in which, just as everything seemed to be collapsing around the ears of those who wished the West well, at that very moment, the foundations were being laid for something new. The other concept, of course, that hovers like a dove over the water in the history of the West is the concept of resurrection. And like the one who was resurrected, that concept is threaded into the fabric of all creation and is known at every moment and never dies. This is the sort of thing that you see, for instance, when Cicero is up against the end of the Republic, as he begins to try to write down the theory and the philosophy that made the Republic great, not just powerful, but actually good. And as he ends up, you know, dying at the hands of the new regime, he couldn't have known, but we can see that the inheritance he left would be the seeds of our Republic, that John Adams would pore over Cicero's speeches and try to understand what it was that made the Republic great and could make ours great again. You look, for instance, at King Josiah, who in 2 Kings recovers the book of the Torah in the temple and has it read aloud, just as Israel is about to suffer its terrible catastrophe because of the sins of Manasseh, that it's going to go into Babylonian exile. But it was those Deuteronomistic texts, those laws, those rituals, those customs that they would take with them that would form the foundation of a new understanding of the Jewish faith that could endure even the fall of the promised land and would indeed endure on into the days of Jesus. And this whole story that is still going on, is still being written, does not stand or fall, does not hang or depend on whether you get your way in the next election, even if that's important. What it depends on is that every day people like you and me wake up and we decide that we are going to choose the good insofar as we possibly can and serve what is best in the world. And that's all we can do. It's enough. It's all we need to do. The rest is up to God.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, scholar Spencer Klavan. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises by Dr. Spencer Klavan. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.